In 2015, the United States and Iran concluded years of difficult diplomacy that froze Iran's nuclear weapons program for a period of years. Not even 2 years later, Donald Trump was president and in May of 2018 withdrew the United States from that agreement. Today's guest warns that while neither the United States nor Iran want a war, the potential for miscalculation and stumbling into war are real. He's Alon Goldenberg this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we talk about big issues with great guests, filmmakers, authors, journalists, and more, to make sense of the stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Alon Goldenberg, a Middle East security expert who's worked in the executive branch and Congress and is currently director of the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. Alon, it's great to see you again.
Oh, great to be here.
So, you know, there's so much that is part of the public dialogue right now about the Middle East, about the nuclear agreement with Iran, about Israel's security and its relationship with its neighbors. We could do three episodes with you. But let's start first talking about the Iran nuclear deal. What was it?
Sure. Well, that's a good question, because there's been a lot of mischaracterization about what it was at this point and a lot of lack of understanding. Look, I think the bottom line is what it was a narrowly constructed agreement to deal with a very specific problem, which was Iran getting a nuclear weapon and making sure you prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. And I think there's a lot of other things people would like it to be. You know, there's concerns about what Iran does in the Middle East. There's concerns about Iran's other, you know, sort of problematic behavior, support for terrorism. But I think what at least the Obama administration did at the time was it just said, look, we have all these problems. But here's the biggest issue. All of them get worse if Iran gets a nuclear weapon. And we, as a global superpower, have this challenge where if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, it has broad global implications for other countries choosing to potentially pursue nuclear weapons, Saudi Arabia or even Venezuela, all kinds of different questions. And so what we're going to do is really focus on this part of the problem and come to a deal that doesn't take away all of Iran's nuclear capabilities, but creates a situation where it is really almost impossible for them to get a nuclear weapon without being caught and stopped. And in exchange for that, we're willing to relieve a lot of pressure on them and give them economic sanctions relief, because this is what had been happening for years, is increasing economic pressure from the global community on them. So that's the basic deal. Iran, you keep your nuclear program restrained in exchange for some economic benefits and integration into the global community.
So it was signed in 2015.
Yes.
The United States, President Trump withdrew the United States from the agreement in May of 2018.
Yes.
In that interim period, was it working?
Yes, I think it was working. Again, it was working if what you cared about ultimately was Iran not getting a nuclear weapon. So, and Iran abided by the agreement at every step of the way. If anything, it was working better for us than it was for the Iranians. The Iranians expected all these economic benefits, and most of them never actually came to pass.
What were some of those benefits that they expected?
Sure. They wanted sales of, so one thing is they wanted to be able to sell their oil on the market. That did come back. That was limited by American and international sanctions in 2013 and 14, and eventually it came back. That's the one benefit they got. But they really wanted their economy to be opened up to the world. And what they found was too many companies were still afraid of going back into Iran in any kind of way for fear of new sanctions coming from the U.S. and cutting them off from the American financial system. So if you're an international company and you're like, well, I can either invest in Iran's economy and potentially lose American banks, or I can choose not to do that. And without American banks, I can't really conduct global commerce. So Iran expected all these things, but we as the U.S. government even, and a lot of our other partners, the Chinese, the Russians, the Europeans, tried to give the Iranians these benefits, but private sector companies were too scared to ever really truly start reinvesting in Iran. And this was all before Trump comes in and before we walk away from the nuclear deal, and then things really get a lot worse for the Iranians.
So what was the rationale for walking away from it with President Trump? I mean, you said it appeared to have been working in terms of the ultimate objective. We don't want Iran to have a nuclear weapon.
So there were some critiques, some of which I think were legitimate, some of which were the two most legitimate critiques. One was that, you know, the deal only lasted for X number of years, 15 years, a number of the limitations would then start to come off. There would be what are called sunset provisions. And so the argument was, well, eventually Iran will be able to get all these benefits and it'll still be able to build a nuclear weapon if it just waits us out. And my counter to that is, well, pretty much every major nonproliferation deal that you have seen in history ultimately has a sunset provision associated with it. And if it's working, you come up with a new deal. And that's what we would have done instead of prematurely walking out of the deal like 2 or 3 years in. The other critique that I also think was, these are legitimate, I just think they're wrong, was, look, Iran still, you know, it's meddling in Syria, it's meddling in Yemen, it's supporting Hezbollah in Lebanon, who's launching rockets at Israel. This deal doesn't address any of that. And that all that bad behavior continues. And that's a legitimate critique. But I think the calculation that was made was we couldn't stop all these things and we needed to focus on what was most important for our interests.
I mean, that seems like a rational way to approach it. You're dealing with the nuclear issue and then the separate issue, related certainly and important, is meddling in these other countries.
Why is the nuclear issue, though? I mean, so we spent the bulk of the last decade sort of dealing with a conflict that grew from America's determination to keep Iraq, at least in terms of public rationale, to keep Iraq from developing nuclear weapons. Why is these countries' access to nuclear weapons such a game changer in terms of American national security community thinking and planning?
Sure. Well, I think there's a lot of different things. So look at Iran. Like, what are the consequences if Iran gets a nuclear weapon? One is groups that they support, like Hezbollah or Hamas, right? Now, Iran has a nuclear weapon that they can provide. I don't think they're going to provide those nuclear weapons to those players, but those players now pretty much have a nuclear umbrella. Any kind of a strike, for example, or a conflict with Israel now has to deal with the fact that this terrorist group might have a partner who's willing to use nuclear weapons, or at least threatening to use nuclear weapons. So, like, that's part of the problem. You can definitely see a scenario where Israel, which is a sort of undeclared nuclear power, they have a nuclear weapons program, they just don't talk about it. And Iran, you have a war between Hezbollah and Israel in Lebanon, which has happened many times before, a few times before. It escalates, and now Iran is threatening nuclear use, and Israel is threatening nuclear use, and you have these two countries who are both really small and live really close to each other. Who have nuclear weapons and don't communicate at all, it starts to sound a little bit like the Cuban Missile Crisis, except much, much worse because there's no communication between the two sides. Not only is there no communication between the two sides, but there's no second strike capability. This is one of the things we always talk about in the nuclear space, right? If you know you have a second strike capability and somebody hits you and you hit them back, that sort of makes things stable. You get the nuclear deterrence.
It's like the Cold War.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But Israel is so small that even if it has enough nuclear weapons to strike back, they're just...
It's existential.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Iran would have such a small nuclear arsenal that they would...
Be use it or lose it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's basically what you've got. So you have issues like that, nuclear exchange. And then you also got issues like, what if Saudi Arabia, once Iran gets a nuclear weapon, decides it wants a nuclear weapon? And then what if Turkey responds? And so now you start getting all kinds of countries across the globe getting nuclear weapons. And the more that have them, like, the more likely somebody uses them. So to me, that's what makes it much more important than, frankly, terrorism is a problem, but it's not terrifying in the same way as the use of nuclear weapons.
So it's a question of magnitude, clearly.
Exactly.
When President Trump talks about this issue, there's sort of some greatest hits that he comes back to. The issues that we've talked about the Iran's bad behavior not being addressed is certainly one of them. The other story that he likes to talk about are just sort of plane loads of cash being flown to the Iranians. Where is the line there between myth and reality?
So I think that what happened there was you did have, basically, you had, you know, a whole bunch of Iranian foreign exchange reserves and money that was, as a result of the sanctions, was tied up in foreign banks. This was part of the sanctions. Iran could not get at this money. It could trade its oil, but it could not actually get this money. And so as part of various deals that were cut, you know, Iran got access to this money, which was already its money. It sold the oil. It's just that because of the sanctions, you know, you sell oil in India, you can't actually figure out how to get that cash back into Iran. And so as part of the sanctions lifting, a whole bunch of money flowed in immediately and quickly as part of this agreement. And so this created all kinds of outrage along the lines of we're giving them, like some of the numbers were $150 billion. I think that the number, the actual estimate by the Treasury Department is it's much smaller than that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was never our money. It was their money that was just sitting there. It wasn't like we, you know, delivered it to them. So there's all kinds of stories like that. They get blown out of proportion in my mind.
How do they get blown out of proportion? I mean, what you said is pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
You know, there's $150 billion and then there's the real number, much less.
How do they get blown out of proportion? I think there's a lot of people who, there's a deep skepticism towards Iran politically.
Okay.
And it goes back to 1979. Like, what does the American public really think about when you, what's the first image that comes
it's
to your mind?
It's the hostage crisis.
It's the hostages and Carter. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so Iran is just viewed through that lens. You know, and so politically, it's easy to go after the Iranians in that way. And then there's also like strong opposition. You know, a lot of our closest partners, specifically Israel and Saudi Arabia, have deep distrust of Iran and competition with Iran in the region. They also have a lot of influence in Washington, various interest groups that then get behind like promoting that. Really, Iran became this massive political football and also an opportunity to go after the Obama administration. So you put all those things together and that, you know, you can take any kind of deal with the Iranians and interpret it in the worst way possible and, you know, insist on, look, we didn't get everything that we wanted. Well, the reality is we didn't. But there's no, show me a major diplomatic breakthrough that has ever gotten you everything that you wanted. That's not the nature of diplomacy. It's
right.
Not how things like
but
that work.
Again, that's maybe a subtle point lost on some people.
Exactly.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a remarkable crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me as he does every week in the co-host chair is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is the author of 17 books and is also an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Alon Goldenberg, a former official at the U.S. State Department, the Department of Defense, and the staff of the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. Alon is currently the director of the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security in Washington, D.C. And you can find Alon on Twitter at Alon Goldenberg. That's ILANGOLDENBERG. You wrote a really compelling article for Foreign Affairs at the start of the summer about what a war with Iran might look like. And I don't want to necessarily get too much into the weeds on that, but one of the things that you said that sort of leapt out at me was that in contrast with North Korea, for example, where you have one person who's in charge, right? Yeah. There are some divisions within the Iranian government that make any sort of contemplated negotiation with the Iranians complicated.
Yeah.
If President Trump were to go through with his desire to talk to the Iranians, what do those divisions look like, and why does that matter?
Sure. I mean, well, Iran's system is interesting in this way. It's not an absolute. It's not like a Stalinist dictatorship. It's much more like a country like Pakistan or something like that. We have all these different power centers and you're trying to figure out who you actually deal with. So the person who runs the country is the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. He's still the ultimate decider, and he's an authoritarian leader who's been around for 30 years. But he has got this whole system around him. There's a president, Hassan Rouhani, who is elected by the population. But only certain candidates are allowed to, you have to be vetted in order to be able to stand for the presidency. So a group of clerics chooses who can actually run for the presidency. Within that, it's democratic, but it's, democratic after you've eliminated most of the possible candidates. And then you've also got this group called the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. This is Iran's military. There's a guy there Qasem Soleimani, who is very well known, who runs what's called the Quds Force, which is their paramilitary wing. These are the guys that are responsible for killing somewhere between 600 and 1,000 Americans in Iraq between, 2003 and 2011. And so you have the military and guys like the IRGC, you have the supreme leader, you have the elected president, then you have all these other actors. And the way the supreme leader works is, if everybody agrees on something, he kind of rolls with it. If there's disagreements, he acts as the tiebreaker. And so his instinct is very much, anti-American. He's actually not left the country in 30 years. He lost use of one of his arms in a terrorist attack that was conducted by a group that he's convinced was supported by the United States, the MEK, which, by the way, still is now not a terrorist group in the United States and comes to a lot of Senate hearings and various things like that. So he's convinced and he has a pretty weird understanding of us. But if all of his people say, you need to do, for example, this nuclear deal, you need to do the JCPOA, he will roll with it. When there's disagreements, he becomes kind of the tiebreaker. And there's also moments where these different actors are all going at each other. I would not, the one thing sometimes there's people say, one part of the system did one thing and another part disagreed and they were undermining each other. And there's some of that going on. There's some of that that happens in our own government. But ultimately, you do have to hold the Iranian government that you're dealing with responsible for its actions. So
I'm curious. So here we are now in 2019. What's the status of the JCPOA? The United States left in May of 2018. Is the agreement completely dead or is it on life support, as it were?
I would say it's on life support. The patient is critically ill at this point, on the verge of dying, probably will be in the next few months. I always say you can still potentially do a transplant and a lot of the elements that were part of the deal can be part of a future deal or agreement. Basically, the president left in, 2018, May 2018. Iran, very unusually for Iran, spent a year being incredibly restrained in its response. It pursued a strategy where it said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to continue to abide by the deal, and we're going to isolate the United States from the other members of the agreement, of the P5 plus one, Russia, China, and some of our European partners, the UK, France, and Germany. They did that, and all of our traditional partners sided with Iran. And that worked for Iran politically. But again, they weren't able to get any economic benefits out of that, because even though these governments wanted to try to find ways to, make Iran whole and keep Iran in the nuclear agreement, none of their companies were interested in doing any business.
Because of the fear that they would lose whatever assets they invested.
Well, the real fear was they'd lose the American market.
Okay.
If they were sanctioned by the United States. Oh. So you give a company, you give a major international company a choice, Iranian market, American market. It's no choice at all. And so for a year, this sort of stasis held. And then just a few months ago, suddenly things started going boom in the Persian Gulf. You had, some attacks on different tankers. You had an announcement by Iran that it was going to start to violate the nuclear deal. All this happened around April and May. And I think what really did it for them was, the Trump administration announced some new sanctions that were now going to take Iran's oil sales almost down to zero. And for the Iranians, this was kind of the last straw. And they said, enough. We've spent a year playing this game of trying to be patient and restrained. It's time to now push back harder, to demonstrate to the United States that there is a cost for doing this, to demonstrate to countries like the UAE and Saudi Arabia that supported the Trump administration's approach, that there's a cost, that if we're not gonna let us sell our oil, we're gonna mess with your oil, which was a strong message. And also just demonstrate to the Europeans and other members of the P5 plus one, guys, you can't keep telling us you're on our side but not doing anything about it. And so since then, we've had this sort of slow motion escalating crisis where Iran is starting to like nibble on the edges, but it's not doing dramatic things. It's not like it's running to a nuclear weapon. It's more like crawling. It's starting. It's slowly its program.
Reminding people what it could do.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you just gave a description of the Iranian government, and it was anything but the monolith that I think a lot of Americans envision it to be. Doesn't the same misperception hold for the Iranian people, that they all sort of follow the supreme leader and they're all docile? We've seen demonstrations over the last few years. Talk about the Iranian people. They're not monolithic. They're not this group of people that just blindly follow their government.
No, their government's actually pretty unpopular at home. In many ways, the Iranians are the Iranian population is one of the most pro-American populations in the Middle East, believe it or not. Partially because of the experience of the last 40 years, and it's a very well-educated population. A lot of them were also educated in the United States before 1979. There was even more of that. But still, even in the current Iranian cabinet, there are more American-educated PhDs than there were either in President Trump's cabinet or in Barack Obama's cabinet. I mean, that's pretty amazing.
It is.
And there are a lot of Iranian Americans that have strong family ties still back in Iran. Farnaz Fasihi, who's now writing for the New York Times, used to write for the Wall Street Journal, someone I know, would be one of those people. So there's still a lot of cultural back and forth between America and the Iranian people. Is that not true?
Absolutely. There's a lot of potential there. And there's kind of two. There's the people who fled Iran in 1979 and lost everything and live in the United States, and they take a very hard line. Mm. And there's another community of people who still have a lot of family at home and want to see the U.S. and Iran repair their relationship. It's much more complicated. But at the same time, I think it's also important to recognize that we're not just on the verge of regime change either, right? I mean, the public is dissatisfied with the regime, but the regime is quite good at controlling the security apparatus. And people don't want a massive revolution either. They've seen that revolutions, frankly, like don't work very well. Their own experience in 1979, but also watching what's gone on in the Middle East over the last 10 years in places like Syria and Egypt and Yemen. You know, these big protests in the Arab Spring hasn't exactly led to, you know.
Well, a model that you would want to emulate, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm curious though. We talked about the divisions and the fissures within the Iranian system, but you've written elsewhere about the divisions within the American system. The difference between the way the president sees it and his national security advisor John Bolton and even his Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Walk us through that set of fissures, if you would.
Sure. So the president's view is, and he keeps making it again and again, is I'm putting pressure back on Iran because I want a better deal. I want to negotiate, right? And so that's why I'm reapplying the sanctions. That's why I walked away from the JCPOA. And he does it consistently. In meetings with foreign officials, he's constantly encouraging others. He's constantly encouraging them, go talk to the Iranians, see if we can get a meeting together. I think he would love to have a big conference like the one he had with Kim Jong-un of North Korea, with Iran's President Rouhani. So that's what he ultimately wants. And he also campaigned on not getting us into new wars in the Middle East. So he's not interested in that at all. I mean, he's very anti that. Then you have Bolton and, to a lesser extent, Pompeo, Bolton in particular has long advocated for military action against Iran.
He's actually used the phrase regime change in Iran.
Yeah, all the time. Yeah, absolutely. He did it, and before he was in government, and even still in some cases, uses this very extreme rhetoric, deeply distrusted. And Pompeo also, when he was a member of Congress, was very hardline anti-Iran to the point of talking about regime change. And so they all agree on one thing, right? Trump wants to reapply sanctions and put all this pressure on so he can get a better deal. Pompeo and Bolton want to reapply pressure, I think really because they want regime change, but they all agree we can reapply pressure and see what happens and just keep blasting the Iranians with sanctions and see if this works. What happens if Trump actually gets into a negotiation? Like, things could get really complicated and confusing because he's going to have his own team against it, which is why I think ultimately, you know, even if you started to get negotiations, I don't think this administration could seriously negotiate something with the Iranians.
Well, so we've got about 2.5 minutes left here. Sure. When you've spent a lot of your time in your career also working on Israeli security issues. What's the relationship between Israel's security and the U.S. relationship with Iran, particularly around the nuclear issue?
Sure. Well, I did this for a number of years, the Pentagon also. And it was almost like in the early, like before the nuclear deal, you really had this three-way game of chicken going on, where the Israelis view a threat of Iran as nuclear Iran as existential. So, but what they really want is they want the United States to take out Iran's nuclear program.
You say take it out, we're talking military action.
I think they would like military action or as much pressure as possible. They like what Trump is doing right now, but they're super worried about what would happen if he got into a new negotiation.
Right.
And so this is where the Israelis are. And they are always going to take the hardest line possible with Iran because they can't tolerate anything. The United States, we're much bigger. We're a global superpower. We are also concerned about Iran's nuclear program, but we can absorb a little more risk. That's just sort of the nature of who we are and the fact that we have two oceans surrounding us instead of a whole bunch of potential hostile actors around us. And so this is what leads sometimes to disagreements between us and Israel on these issues. But, you know, there's a way to bridge those gaps, I think, working together, communicating, reassurance, and partnership, which is what we've done in the past and did until the last few years of the Obama administration, where things just got really ugly and you got into this massive confrontation between Bibi Netanyahu and Barack Obama.
We've got literally about 30 yeah. seconds left, and this is horribly unfair. But so what are the prospects for peace between Israel and Palestine at this point in our history?
I think for the moment, my short answer is you need new leadership everywhere. You need new Israeli leadership. You need new Palestinian leadership. You need new American leadership to be able to have a serious chance of trying to negotiate something. I don't think the two-state solution is dead, but I think it's on life support and it's in a tough spot right now, and we need to be doing everything we can to just keep it alive and going until we have better people on all sides to try to do something.
That's where we're going to need to leave it. Ilan Goldenberg, thank you so much for being with us. That's all the time we have this week. But if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit PellCenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.